Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and this is the 7th episode of SFN Shorts, featuring interviews with early career researchers that I conducted at the Society for Neuroscience Conference last November. You can find the previous 6 episodes of SFN Shorts, as well as the posters for this episode, on the website at inplainenglishpod.org. We will be back again next week with another episode of SFN Shorts, so stay tuned for that. Without further ado, let's get into the episode. Our first presenter for this episode is Tanya Lintz, a graduate student at Washington University in St. Louis in the lab of José Morón Concepción and also one of my close friends. Their research focuses on opioid use disorder and specifically identifying factors that could be protective against developing opioid use disorder. Specifically, they have identified a gene called Cornichone 3. Yes, it's named after the pickle, that mutations in that gene might be protective against opioid use disorder. So they are studying this gene in mice and knocking out the gene, getting rid of it entirely, and studying whether that protects these mice against developing opioid use disorder and whether or not that is different between males and females.
I could introduce you, but I'd like you to introduce yourself.
Sounds good. Hi, I'm Tanya Lintz. I'm a 4th-year graduate student in the PhD program at Washington University in St. Louis in the lab of José Morón Concepción. And I study sex differences in the role of Cornichone 3 in opioid seeking.
Cool, yeah. Let's hear about your research.
Awesome. Yeah, so my work is based on a genome-wide association study that was done in 2016, where the researchers were looking at populations of people that were all exposed to opioids, and they saw that there was a group of people who increased in their opioid use over time. They escalated to daily use, and then there was a group of people who took opioids recreationally but never increased in their use to this daily use. So what this GWAS found is that there were commonalities in the people who did not escalate to daily opioid use, and these were single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, in Cornichone 3. So it looks like alterations in this gene are protective against opioid-seeking behavior. And what Cornichone 3 is it's an AMP receptor auxiliary protein. It aids in this excitatory glutamatergic activity in key parts of the brain that are necessary for learning and memory, and specifically opioid cue associations. This brain region is called the dorsal hippocampus. And so what I'm trying to do here with my work is look at how Cornichone 3 affects fentanyl-seeking behavior using an IV self-administration paradigm.
So you're using mice?
Yes.
And these mice are, can you explain like the how they're giving themselves morphine or?
Fentanyl. Yes. So I do have a mouse model of a Cornichone 3 knockout. So this is a global knockout of Cornichone 3. These animals don't produce Cornichone 3. And so this really lets us identify what are the effects of this gene contributing to or not contributing to this opioid-seeking behavior. And so what we do is we take these animals and we implant a jugular vein catheter, which allows them to go into a little box where they have 2 nose poke holes. And they can poke one that has a light cue. When they poke that, they get 1 infusion of fentanyl. And when they poke the other nose port, they don't get any fentanyl. So they have to learn to poke this cued port. It takes them a couple of sessions to do so, but they learn it really quickly that once they poke this port, they get the fentanyl, which is rewarding for them. And so what we see, I'm interested in looking at sex differences in this effect because reanalysis of this GWAS data showed that SNPs in Cornichone 3 were more protective in women than in men. And so I have male and female wild-type animals that don't have any alterations in their Cornichone 3 gene, and our Cornichone 3 knockout animals, both male and female. What we can see across IV self-administration of fentanyl is that our wild-type animals, there's no sex differences between them. The males and females take similar amounts of fentanyl, but both of our knockout groups take less fentanyl across all of this acquisition period than their wild-type counterparts.
Okay, so it is still protective in the mice.
Yes.
So yeah, the knockout was protective in mice, kind of similar to how the mutations were protective in humans.
Then I wanted to kind of take a zoomed in look across this acquisition period to see how the animals are changing in their intake over time. And what we can see is that our wild type males and our wild type females that have normal Cornichon 3 increase in their intake over time, which is what we would expect for a paradigm such as this. As the animals take more drug, they make the associations, they increase in their intake as time goes on. We see this as well in the knockout female. So they are increasing over time, but they take less drug across the board still, even on phase 3 as compared to their female counterparts. Our males, however, don't increase in their intake over time. So it appears that there's a difference here between what this knockout is doing for males and what it's doing to the females.
Yeah. So hang on. So in humans, the mutations, which are not knockouts, are, you said they're more protective in females.
Yes.
And then here we're actually seeing that the complete knockout is more protective in males. Like they're not acquiring the behavior, or they're not taking more fentanyl the way that the females are taking more fentanyl.
Right.
So why do you think it's kind of the inverse of what the human data saw?
Yeah, so Cornichon 3 is a gene that's involved in learning and memory. And so what it appears to be here is that potentially there's a cognitive effect in the females. And then something that I'll investigate further is how these animals interact with their reward. So there could be a difference in sensitivity to fentanyl, and there could be differences in motivations for fentanyl. And so I think that's what's going on in the males, and the females potentially have this cognitive effect that they're less interested in drug, they have difficulty making this association at the beginning, but then once it's made, they do kind of do this this increase in intake over time. And to kind of test this, I did a sucrose self-administration and cognitive flexibility assay to see and kind of check the cognition of these animals. And it's also important to see, using a sucrose reward, whether this effect is something that's opioid specific or reward specific. And so first we have a cue association phase where the animals have to poke the cued nose port, except this time they're getting one sucrose pellet every time they poke. And what we can see during this phase is that our wild-type males and our knockout males acquire this behavior really quickly. Our wild-type females also acquire it really quickly, but the knockout females take a really long time to make this association. It takes them almost double the number of sessions to reach this acquisition criteria.
Wow. So it's, just like kind of a learning thing then.
Yes, for the females, definitely. Then we do a cue disassociation phase where the animals have to poke their uncued nose port in order to get an infusion a pellet of sucrose. And this is testing whether the animals are able to adapt to a changing set of rules. And what we can see is that our knockout males do a pretty good job at this. And our knockout females are struggling with this. So it appears that this is definitely not an opioid specific effect. And it has to do with cognition in the females.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so if it was a cue learning effect, then potentially in people, this mutation isn't necessarily specific to opioids either. It's potentially more specific to just learning about rewards in the environment in general.
Right.
And that, with some of these mutations, maybe people aren't making that connection as easily. It's not as hardwired in your brain that you're I'm in this place and I take opioids, right?
Right.
So then that would be protective because they're not habitually seeking that reward in that place, but it could also be for sugar in people, right?
Yes.
They could also not be over consuming sugar as much.
Yes, for sure. And also we know that opioid cues are really important when it comes to relapse. Opioid cues are really potent even years after a person has abstained from drugs for a long time. And so being able to kind of dissect these opioid cue associations and reward cue associations can potentially help us mitigate the opioid crisis in that way.
Cool. And so then, what are your next directions for this?
Yeah, so the next directions will be kind of to tease apart more of the behavioral differences of what's going on in the males, more of that sensitivity and motivation for fentanyl, and then kind of trying to look at a mechanism of what is Cornichon 3 doing in the presence of opioids during this opioid cue association learning.
Well, thank you.
Of course.
Our second interview for this episode is with Jessica Higginbotham, a postdoctoral fellow at Washington University in St. Louis in the lab of Jose Moron Concepcion. Her research focuses on how pain affects opioid use disorder, and specifically sex differences between males and females in how pain might impact their likelihood to develop opioid use disorder. She is studying this in rodents and looking at different brain areas and how those areas of the brain and signaling within those areas of the brain might impact the effect of pain on opioid use.
First, can you just introduce yourself?
I'm Jessica Higginbotham, and I'm a postdoc at WashU in the Moron Concepcion Lab. And I study sex differences and the effects of pain on opioid use, mostly because we know there's been this increase in overdose deaths in recent years that's been fueled by the use of synthetic opioids like fentanyl. But something that really hasn't been looked at until recently are the sex differences and these gender differences within this, and that males historically are overdosing more than two times than women. And so when we ask users what their motivation is for abusing drugs, typically the most commonly reported thing is that they are seeking pain relief. So we wanted to see if possibly in the context of pain, if this is what's driving these gender differences that we see at the population level. So we use a preclinical model of fentanyl self-administration, and in order to put them in this pain state, we give them hind paw injections of CFA, which is a myobacteria that produces persistent inflammation in the hind paw for up to 6 weeks.
Yeah, their paws kind of look puffy and red.
Yes, exactly.
It looks unpleasant.
Right, so then they can go into a box and there's levers, and one of the levers is gonna give them a fentanyl infusion, and it goes directly through a line to their jugular vein, so they get instant gratification every time they press that lever, and they learn really quickly how to distinguish between the levers, and that I press this lever, I get fentanyl if I want it. So we allowed them to do this for 2-hour sessions over 3 weeks and looking at pain and no pain. And when we look at our female rats with pain, we see absolutely no effects. So they're really stable over time and their amount of fentanyl consumption. But then in our males, we see that with each successive week, they're taking more and more fentanyl than the males without pain or any of these female groups. They're also responding for higher doses of fentanyl when they're available, and they don't, they appear to be resistant to any motivational deficits produced by pain, because it's in our female groups. If we do a progressive ratio task where they have to exponentially pay more in lever presses for each time that they respond to get an infusion, in females with pain, they do this less, but in males with pain, they're not different than their non-pain counterparts.
Right. The females in pain are just like, screw this, it's too hard. And the males in pain are still like, press.
Commonly in pain, people might interpret this as something that has to do with negative reinforcement. So maybe it's the males that are, they're in pain more. And so that's why they're taking more drug or they need more pain relief. But really that's not the case. So I titrate the amount of CFA that I put into the hind paw. And what we see is like the amount of inflammation that we get in the paw is really similar, and this is maintained over the 3 weeks of self-administration. Their actual mechanical sensitivity, so this is how we assess pain by just seeing how many grams of pressure that paw can withstand, is really similar over time. And then also the amount of analgesia that this low dose of fentanyl can produce is stable over time. So it's not necessarily the development of hyperalgesia or anything like that, or differences in baseline pain thresholds. So I think it has something to do with actual reward processing. So to kind of assess that, we did wireless fiber photometry, where we express a calcium indicator within the VTA. It's like a primary dopamine hub. So anytime you take a drug of abuse, you're going to get this big surge in dopamine release, and that's going to come from the VTA. So that's where we decided to look specifically in these dopamine neurons. And we compare that with their actual responding on the lever, so that when they press the lever, we can see that how big that actual surge in dopamine cell activity is. So when we do this over time, just kind of like the behavior, the females are super consistent regardless of whether they are in pain or not. But in the males, the amount of dopamine cell activity that we get from this population of cells increases over time at a similar rate that they're increasing their actual fentanyl use. So not only are their responses getting stronger, they also become more efficient. So not every time they press a lever do they actually get big release of dopamine, but they get better at that over time as they're taking more drug. And this is correlated with the actual amount of drug that they take during the session. So because it's week 3 time point, this last week in the training is where we saw the biggest differences. We decided to see, okay, well, since we have this big increase in VTA dopamine cell activity at this week 3 time point, and we have this big increase in fentanyl consumption at this time point, perhaps if we inhibit this population of cells, that will reduce the effect of pain on the behavior. And so we do this by expressing an inhibitory G-protein coupled receptor that can be activated by a ligand called CNO. So if we inject that ligand, we can inhibit this cell population that we are recording from within these VTA dopamine cells. And so by doing that, we still get a response. It's just not quite as pronounced as we would normally see, but we're no longer increasing our intake during that week 3 time point. We're not necessarily reducing in the intake, but we're taking the same as we were the week before. So
it's stable.
Exactly. So they're not transitioning to this maladaptive pattern of behavior that we would like to see. Then we wanted to know what it could be that is protecting females in this. So why is it that pain has no effect on fentanyl use in females? So first thing we did was track the ester cycle in females, which is goes through 4 different stages, and looked at the amount of fentanyl that they were consuming across the stages, and it was very stable. So we didn't think it had to do with any differences in actual circulating hormones or fluctuations in the hormones that were there. So we thought, well, maybe if we remove the hormones altogether, maybe we can put them in a more male-like state if, in fact, the females are protected by the presence of these ovarian hormones. And what we saw is that doing an ovariectomy in our females, we can actually generate a male-like response to fentanyl, and so much so that it's much greater than our intact females, very similar to our male groups. So then we want to see, okay, well, if the removal of ovarian hormones, it can essentially protect females from this effect. Perhaps if we give them estradiol, it can bring them back to the state that they were before the ovariectomy, but it does not, interestingly. However, you do this in the males, you give the male estradiol, we can suppress the response and put them into a more female-like state. So they have a lower dopamine response now to opioids, and we have a similar effect on the behavior. So they're no longer increasing their intake anymore, but now they have a reduction in their intake.
And that's just so giving the males estrogen causes them to have less of the dopamine release. They don't increase their behavior. In fact, they might like decrease their fentanyl intake. But why do you think that giving estrogen or estradiol back to the females doesn't do the same thing?
I think this story is telling us that it's not just estradiol. Like, we need other things on board. I didn't castrate the males or anything in this.
Right.
And
so they still have a lot of testosterone
exactly.
on board, too.
They have the testosterone, they have progesterone, there are other things going on. I think it's more of like a balance type thing. So a high estrogen state could be what's protecting females from this effect, and obviously removing the ovaries, like that's a pretty crude approach in general. So there could be a whole lot of other plasticity happening during the recovery period and differences in receptor expression and things like that.
Would kind of a more similar approach be to like just give testosterone to the females and like estrogen to the males? Or
yeah, and that's something I think that we are going to look at doing going forward, to see if we can mimic the male-like state in the females by boosting their testosterone. So the last thing we wanted to do was just see if really the estradiol is acting within the brain somewhere to have these effects on dopamine. And so we thought within the VTA, we know that there's estrogen receptors expressed there in both males and females. There's two major types, estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. And so what we did is we implanted cannula targeted at the VTA so that we could locally infuse a pharmacological agent to block either one of these receptor populations and then see what happens to dopamine cell responses to fentanyl. And so as you might guess, when we block either of these in females that have been ovaryectomized, we have no effect whatsoever on the response. In males, we can only change the response when estradiol is on board, which makes sense. If they are already in a low estrogen state, it wouldn't make sense that blocking either receptor within the VTA would change what we see. But really, it's the estrogen receptor beta within the VTA, when we have estradiol there, that can essentially restore the response that we saw. So blocking that receptor can bring them back to a more male-like state.
Okay.
After they've been given estradiol.
So more signaling through the beta estrogen receptor is more protective.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
And I don't have it on here, but actually we have the same estrogen receptor beta effect when females are intact.
Okay.
So that kind of plays again to my theory that everything's got to be there. It's more about a balance rather than an all or nothing.
Right. It's a whole system of hormones and regulation. So what do you think the pathway is, like the link between the estrogen receptor and the like dopamine release?
That is an excellent question. So one thing was that we don't know what cell type these receptors are expressed on. There are some older papers to show that perhaps that there's a different distribution pattern of estrogen receptors between males and females, and that males within the VTA have higher levels of estrogen receptors on dopamine neurons specifically, but there's also a whole network of inhibitory cells that inhibit dopamine neurons that could also express these. So part of what we're working on now in collaboration with other labs is to see where exactly the receptors are expressed.
Yeah, that's really awesome work.
Thank you.
Do you see, going back to kind of the human data, where you see like people's primary motivation for using opioids is pain relief, do you see that in both males and females, or is it like males saying that more?
It's across males and females.
Okay.
So it's pretty common in people that have an opioid use disorder or a history of abuse that the more opioids they take, the more pain they have when opioids aren't around, just in general.
Right. But hopefully we can then like use this to like develop better treatments and understand.
Yeah, more targeted treatments.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of evidence that women post-menopause have higher rates of abuse and higher instances of overdose. So it could have something to do with hormonal regulation.
Which kind of tracks, yeah, with exactly what you were saying, that hormone regulation changing.
Exactly.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our final interview for this episode is with Anthony Jurgi, a graduate student at Boston College. He uses rats to study how different brain areas are involved in stress and social interactions, and in this study, used viruses to silence neurons in these brain regions and study how that affected the social interactions of the rats.
Hi, first off, can you introduce yourself?
I'm Anthony Jurgi. I'm a fifth-year grad student in John Christensen's lab in Boston College.
Very cool, very cool. Yeah, and so can you take me through a little bit of the research you've been doing?
Sure. So we do rodent research. We study social affective behavior, which is the process by which somebody or someone detects and appraises and responds to the emotional states of others. And we study that in the context of a social affective preference test, where a test rat is presented with two conspecifics, one that is stressed and one that is not stressed.
So a conspecific is just another rat?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And those conspecifics can be juveniles or adults. And in this paradigm that we use, we find that test rats actually change their behavior depending on stress and age of the conspecifics, the other rats in the cages. We find that adult test rats actually prefer interactions with stressed juveniles, but avoid interactions with stressed adults. And that is evident in this score, that in this percent preference score, where we take the time they spend interacting with the stress conspecific over the total time spent interacting. And a score above 50% indicates preference for the stress conspecific, a score below indicates preference for the naive conspecific. So we see that adult test rats prefer interactions with stressed juveniles, but avoid interactions with stressed adults.
How are they stressed?
We give them 2 5-second foot shocks.
Oh.
Yes.
That sounds stressful.
Yes, it's more of an annoyance than it is a painful experience. But it's just enough that the rats are stressed in response.
And is this the same with male and female rats?
In this case, yes. So both male and female adult rats show this behavior.
Okay, so they want to help out the babies, but they don't.
They want to protect themselves from the stressed adult. Yeah, so this behavior is actually dependent on the insular cortex, which is a region that is involved in sensory integration, and in humans is involved in empathy. So shutting off this region during this behavior actually abolishes this preference for juveniles and adults that we see. So I was interested in studying how other brain regions are involved in this behavior. So we have viral methods that we can use to target specific neural pathways in the brain and either inhibit or excite them. So turn them on or turn them off and see how that interferes with a rat's behavior. So in this case, I was looking at insular cortex projections to the prefrontal cortex, specifically the prelimbic cortex, which is a region that is involved in executive function and goal-directed behavior and also social behavior. So disturbance of neural circuitry in this region has been shown to affect social behavior, hence why I chose this as my target region. So I'm going to not go into the nitty-gritty details of how we do this.
Right.
Basically, I can inhibit cells in the prelimbic cortex that specifically receive input from either anterior insula, which is more toward the front of the brain, and posterior insula, which is more toward the back of the brain. So inhibition of these neural populations that receive input from anterior insula abolishes preference for stressed juveniles and slightly changes preference for naive adults. Typically, we see an effect here. Our data is normally distributed, so there are times where within our cohort of 12, we have 3 or 4 rats that show the wrong preference. So this is normal, unfortunately. But we've seen enough of this trend that this could just be an odd group of rats. We convert these scores to a percent preference score, as I said earlier. And what we see here is under CNO, test rats lose preference for stressed juveniles and have an increased preference for stressed adults when this pathway is inhibited, the anterior insula to prelimbic pathway. Similarly, targeting the posterior insula to PL pathway, inhibition of these neural populations also abolishes preference for stressed juveniles, naive adults, and we see this again in our percent preference score, this decrease in preference for the stressed juvenile, increase in preference for stressed adults.
Okay.
So both of these pathways are involved in this behavior. And I separated these two because along the rostral caudal gradient of the insula, so front to back, there is evidence that there is functional diversity between anterior and posterior insula, where anterior insula is involved in more appetitive behaviors and posterior insula is involved in more aversive behaviors.
Okay. So the anterior is more involved in like when the rat likes something, and then the aversive is obviously the reverse.
Yeah.
But you saw more or less the same effect of shutting off this, both populations, both the one that's coming from the more forward area and the one that's coming from the like more back, towards the back of the insula.
Yes, yeah. So this data could have really been collapsed together, but I separated it because our lab has mostly focused on posterior insula. So I did want to see if there was any difference with anterior insula. And in this case, there wasn't. And I was also interested in determining whether these neurons are specifically involved in more complex social interactions. So where stress is involved and it's a little bit more uncertain what to do in those scenarios. So I manipulated the SAP test to just be male versus female conspecifics, and should have prefaced this before, but this is done in all males.
Okay.
So my assumption with these tests was that male test rats would prefer female conspecifics, so the opposite sex conspecifics, just because this is driven by maybe more mesolimbic structures that drive more of those behaviors. So this data has actually collapsed with both sets of these rats, anterior and posterior targets. And what I found is that inhibition of these PL cells that receive input from either anterior or posterior insula has no effect on preference for opposite sex conspecifics.
And none of these rats are stressed.
None of these rats are stressed.
Okay. They're just chilling.
They're just chilling.
Okay. And so for this kind of like male versus female, nobody's stressed, then like that information coming from the insula to the prelimbic area, like it's not that important.
No, it's not. Yeah.
Okay. And they're still going to have that same preference for the female rat.
Yes.
There's a couple that don't.
Oh yeah,
like,
there are always a few ones that buck the trend.
They're like, yes, screw the female rat.
Yeah. So these prelimbic neurons that receive input from either anterior or posterior insula are necessary for social affective behaviors involving stressed conspecifics, but not necessary for behaviors involving opposite sex conspecifics, or at least opposite sex preference.
Yeah, that's super. So do you think, I mean, I know that you did this in both males and females initially, where like both males and females show this behavior where they will approach a stressed juvenile and avoid a stressed adult.
Yeah.
Do you think that if you did this manipulation where you inhibited these projections in females and you did their social interaction, do you think you would see kind of the same thing?
I do. So we have past studies showing that the insula and the amygdala in females is involved in this behavior. So there's enough evidence that this behavior is not sex specific, that I would assume that this pathway is involved in females as well. We did try it out in females. They seem to be a little bit more sensitive to any experiment or manipulations, so they don't perform as well in the vehicle condition after all these procedures have been done.
Right. Now they're kind of stressed too.
Right.
And they're like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, so stress of the test rat does also influence how they behave. Yeah, but I would assume it would be similar results if this worked in females.
And so like how, I mean, not all research has to be directly translational, but like what's kind of the relationship between like studying how the rats are affected during this test with like, you know, what these brain areas might be doing in people?
Yeah, so a lot of these brain regions are conserved evolutionarily. So rats have similar functions for their insula that humans do. So a lot of these structures that we study show aberrant, functional connectivity or function in general in humans that suffer from ASD or schizophrenia or PTSD. And a lot of those manifest as out of the ordinary social interactions. So studying these in rats gives us a clearer picture of how those brain regions could be involved in any symptoms that are common to ASD, people with ASD or disorders such as that.
Cool. Yeah, that's really interesting work.
Thank you.
Thank you for agreeing to be recorded.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you all for tuning in to the 7th episode of SFN Shorts. Once again, this episode featured Tanya Lintz, Jessica Higginbotham, and Anthony Jurgi. You can follow along with the posters on the website at inplainenglishpod.org. We will be back next week on February 20th with another episode of SFN Shorts, so stay tuned for that. Please also stay tuned for some exciting announcements coming up for In Plain English. Safe to say this is going to be a very exciting year for the podcast. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.